between the wisdom passed down by ancient healing traditions, anecdotal experience, and modern clinical trials, one thing is clear: mushrooms are medicinal powerhouses. And I finally found a brand, a product, a company that I feel really aligns with all of my research and understanding when it comes to the medicinal properties of mushrooms, and that is Alchemy Mushrooms. They grow their mushrooms in California on organic mushroom farms. They keep the whole mushroom in their supplements, and they actually blend mycelium and fruit body in their mushroom powders and capsules to give you the best of both worlds. You can learn more at Alchemy Mushrooms. That's A-L-C-H-E-M-I. AlchemyMushrooms.com. Use the discount code MushroomHour for 20% off your order. Alchemy with an I, Mushrooms.com. Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on the Mushroom Hour podcast, we're joined by the amazing Zhaojing Yin. Zhaojing is a Chinese-Canadian artist whose work embraces the combination of her Chinese roots and her education at Nanjing Arts Institute with a higher education at George Brown College in Toronto and an MFA in sculpture at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Her unique point of view brings together the past and present, and encompassing culture and nature, art and science. Yen is a recipient of numerous awards and grants, including the 2014 Outstanding Young Alumni Award from Indiana University of Pennsylvania. She's received project grants from the Canadian Council for the Arts, the Chalmers Arts Fellowship, mid-career grants from Ontario Arts Council, and many more. Most recently, she's had solo shows at Maison Hermes in Shanghai, China, Art Gallery of Northumberland in Ontario, Canada, Richmond Art Gallery in British Columbia, Canada, and Suzhou Museum in Suzhou, China. Yan has also completed public art projects and commissions in Canada and China, including her 2018 installation called Cloudscape at the Royal Ontario Museum and a 2019 window display dubbed Into the Dream for Maison Hermes. It's my pleasure to learn more about the unique ethos behind her art and her intimate relationship with Lingji Mushroom. Zhaojing, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour podcast.
Thank you, Darren. Thanks for the introduction, and it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, the pleasure is all mine after being a big fan of your art. I was so excited when you responded that you're willing to come on the show, because I'm so curious to learn always about artists and what inspires them, and usually unique perspectives that you're bringing through in your creations. So the pleasure is definitely all mine. And, you know, before I start trying to ask every question I can think of about your art and the ideas behind it, I do like to start with an introduction to yourself. You know, the influences that brought you into the world of art and creation, and maybe how some early life experiences may have influenced where you are today.
Yes, I like to draw and paint since I was very young. I spent a lot of time making drawings, paintings, and crafts. And I wanted to be an artist, even I didn't know what being an artist meant at the time. Yeah. So both my parents were not in the art field or even had much knowledge in art at all. They still don't. But they appreciate more of the realistic styles, you know, of paintings I did when I was younger. But when I told them when I want to apply for art school, then they didn't approve, because in their eyes, art was merely a hobby. Then I, you know, should only enjoy it to a certain extent, but should not pursue it as a career. They did not see the future in the art for me. And so we had a lot of fight about that. And then they actually let me choose what I wanted. I really appreciate their understanding and the support, even this wasn't their preference. Yeah. And also in China, you know, the culture, parents usually decide what program or which school their kids, you know, would apply, and not much freedom for, you know, kids to, you know, to have their free wills. But now this things change has improved a lot. But, you know, back then it was, you know, much of the parents' will. And now think back of that, I even more appreciate that my parents being, you know, so understanding and respect of my own, you know, own will. And even later, they led me to leave the country to pursue whatever life I wanted, even I had no idea what will come out. Yeah. So I always think my parents were, you know, very kind of like liberal parents. Yeah. So yeah, but you know, being able to go to the art school I wanted was only just the start of my art journey. And it was not, you know, just a happy error after ending kind of, you know. And after I went to art school in China, and I kind of lost my direction. I didn't know what I should do with art. It was kind of lots of realistic questions came up. I started to understand my parents' concern. And so I got this opportunity to leave China to see what in the outside world. So I left China, I came to Canada. And then I taught at like art classes, like I taught little kids, and I did design works, graphic design works. And none of those was the things I liked. And I decided to go to jewelry program. So I went to George Brown College to study jewelry. And I got the highest GPA among my, you know, classmates. But still, I just feel after I learned all those techniques of how to fabricate, how to, you know, how to solder, how to weld, how to cast and polish, you know, all those techniques, I still feel, you know, it wasn't something I like to spend hours in front of a bench making a small scenes and use our one gauge to measure it to like a point, some centimeter, a millimeter dimension. So this was too technical in a way. Right. Then I decided to go to a graduate school. I was really interested in installation. And I was amazed by how artists could involve basically everything in their work. And so I applied for graduate school. And I went to Indiana University of Pennsylvania for the sculpture program. And that was really a pivotal time for me. So I learned a lot, not only about how to make, create work. More importantly is the critical thinking, the theoretical approach of making art. Yeah. So then I totally dove into the art world after I graduated.
Well, that's interesting. You're kind of talking about there's the skill in crafting art, you know, with whatever medium you're using. And then there's kind of that narrative element or the story you're trying to tell or the emotion you're trying to convey. So it sounds like that's a really critical part to creating art, is to start with what you're trying to bring through or create in a potential viewer, or what message you're trying to put out there.
Yeah, I think space is very important for me. When I go to our space, whether it's indoor or outdoor, and I get very excited to envision, to think, to imagine my work, to engage in that space, to encourage the viewer go into the spirit space and to be part of the artwork, so which would never be achieved by smaller scale works. But I still make jewelry sometimes, but I do see them differently. They are not as the functional jewelry I was trying to make when I was in school. They're more like this art being displayed on a different place. Yeah.
And again, that can be an art form like the installations that you've moved to now. Jewelry could be an expression that does intimately involve the viewer, because ultimately they'll be wearing the piece potentially.
Yeah, just, you know, see how you see it in a different perspective. Yeah, they don't need to be carried away physically. They can be just embrace you, encapsulate you in that space.
Right.
Yeah, to engage you like differently than the jewelry, functional traditional jewelry. Yeah.
These three-dimensional art pieces, whether it's jewelry or definitely with a big installation space, it requires a certain kind of imagination that I'm not sure I have, but a certain kind of depth of imagination to see how something three-dimensional like that will transform and evolve the viewer. And it's really exciting to hear that about that journey for you, that evolution to reaching that point, you know, that you've worked through a lot of different disciplines. And I mean, what I'm also getting from it is a lot of bravery to follow this path of the artist. And having known, you know, many artists in my life, I think, you know, everyone has a little artist within them, but that path of choosing art as a vocation does require a lot of bravery to really pursue that creative path when it isn't always apparent on how that will make money or, you know, what kind of job you'll have. And I'm always struck by the bravery. And it sounds like for you, that was the journey as well, as kind of stepping into the unknown to follow this passion for creating.
Yeah, exactly. I feel I did not find art found me. Mm-hmm. And it's always provided me the harbor when I need it. You know, along the way, I figure out things out with the art. Yeah, it's solid for me. It's kind of journey.
Yeah, well, and it sounds like it's just, like you're saying, it's calling you. You don't have a choice, which is something I also find with a lot of artists who's, it's just the only thing that you can do. Now, you also have an interesting story moving from, you know, an Eastern culture, a really deep ancient culture there in China, and then moving over to Canada, which I would imagine is a very different culture. How did this transition affect your art, or how did that start working its way into the art pieces that you create?
Yeah, Chinese culture, the training and the tradition inspire my work. My experience of living in US and Canada, adapting outside of my native culture, molds and informs my work. I really appreciate the richness of my multicultural background. And I'm motivated in my practice to find new ways to breathe life into those very specific Chinese ideas, the traditions, rituals, and materials rich in religion, a mythology, and a culture. Also, my work combines stylistic conventions and iconographies that readily relate to the traditional Chinese art aesthetics, but they're not supposed to be purely nostalgia or recaptive. But instead, they are more capacious and exist in the present moment, as you said earlier. They're engaging in issues of greater concerns of current significance, and such as climate change, and then the challenge it presented to our environment and the nature.
So you're bringing some of these traditional Chinese practices into the present, but also through the lens of a Western culture that is newer in many ways than Chinese culture. So you're kind of bringing a more ancient tradition to a younger culture and then looking at some of the more modern issues or themes that we're faced with today. It creates a really interesting blend when you look at the work to see those themes at play. And then your work also deals a lot with a balance, not only between these cultures, but also between ideas of nature and science, right? How did that start working its way into your work? I mean, was this always a theme that was important to you, or did it gradually start becoming more and more prominent in the works you produce?
Yeah, it's gradually developed. At the very beginning, my art was more focused on the personal and cultural identity, as that was the main focus for me to dealing with my life as being a new immigrant and all those struggle, difficulties, and isolations I was facing. So I was in the need to solving those problems. And after years of living in the West, if it's not a perfect balance, but I find a more balanced life, so that I kind of moved my focus from those struggle, conflict, and you know, this kind of more even new immigrant struggle. And then I have more space in my mind to think about other issues that in my life that, you know, people are facing and the issues in the society. And then slowly, when I, you know, I, my work always inspired by the Chinese tradition, and nature has been the prominent theme, like the component in the Chinese tradition. So that is, has been always apparent in my art. Then I start thinking the current issues and then compare that with the culture theme I have been always focused on. Then this nature and the science relation has become more emerged in my art.
I'm always struck by that when you look at Chinese culture. It seems to have or elevate nature, and there's always a reverence for nature embedded, I mean, in the language, certainly in the art, different traditions. You know, as someone who's experienced both Eastern and now Western culture and made them both kind of part of who you are, do you think that the Western world has something to learn from Chinese culture and Eastern cultures about humans' relationship with nature? You know, I said before that Western Europe, America, you know, these are younger cultures than China. Do you think we have something to learn about humans' relationship with nature that you've seen in your experience?
I think, yeah, definitely there are, not only from Chinese culture, but also from many indigenous cultures too. I think these older cultures has a lot of respect to the nature than we have now. Like contemporary China now, we actually have closely followed the Western modernization footstep. Mm-hmm. And in some area, even went beyond. And it has caused a lot of problem. And for China, it has lost a lot of respect for nature than our ancestors did. And the traditional Chinese culture has highly valued the nature. We can see from lots of the paintings. In Chinese traditional painting, nature was often dominant and humans only depicted as a small part of nature. But in Western art, we can see in the Renaissance paintings, humans often depict as a main subject. Nature often just presented as a far background. And so that's kind of already demonstrated that the attitude towards nature in different cultures. And also in China, according to, you know, we are deeply influenced by Buddhist, Taoist, and Confucian traditions. So Buddhist philosophy think man consists just like one class of living beings. And also man have no right to unlimitedly exploitations of animal and plant life. Those are the part of nature, and we should, you know, treat them with respect. And the Confucian tradition also believes that the idea of the unity of heaven and humanity. And also Taoism believe human beings are inextricably woven into the fabric of our natural environment. And according to Taoist beliefs, man is a crucial component of the natural world that is advised to follow the flow of nature's rhythms. And Taoism also teaches that people, we should maintain a close relationship with nature for the best moral and physical health. So, but the Western modernization is a rapidly widening control of nature. And every milestone in the modernization history is a step forward in controlling the nature. Yeah, so during this process, when man, we become so complacent and arrogant, and we kind of acting like we're the God. And the Westerners, I think maybe we should call moderns, tend to think that men were quite separate and superior from the natural world. And we can see that countries that are, and some cultures that are so advanced in modernization have lost a lot of the tradition of the respect for nature. You know, even the modernization has improved greatly our living conditions, but you know, with the ignorance of the nature, and then this balance has been broken. And then we have to really reflect how much we can extract from nature and how can we restore the balance now.
Well, it sounds like what you're calling into question is the balance between human-centered progress, anthropocentric progress, and actually having homeostasis or a balanced relationship with nature. And I would have to guess that for you personally, you think that we need to go more towards, we need to return to some of these principles of balance with nature, you know, to actually move forward. The best progress is going to be grounded in a return to nature and a better understanding of how our actions affect the natural world. It sounds like that's kind of the thought that you're trying to provoke in a viewer. It sounds like that's kind of your belief. Is that right?
Yes, I do believe that looking into the past will help us to figure out a way out for the nature.
I love that idea of the modernist, not the Westerner, but there's the modernist who's driven to progress, humans first, which I think is a natural impetus. But I think there's a reason why so many ancient cultures arrived at an understanding that there had to be a balance with nature, because if you go too far in the direction of only progress for humans, everything else is negatively affected. And that only comes back to then affect humans negatively as well. Yeah. Can you pinpoint a piece, an installation or sculptural piece that was one of your first at really exploring this relationship with nature and maybe getting people to think or getting people to question what that relationship looks like today? Is there a piece that stands out to you that kind of signaled a shift in that direction?
Well, I would say my first piece pronounce this aspect of nature and human relationship. It's the pearl piece. I call it a pearl piece. It's an installation made of thousands of freshwater pearls. So yeah, I hang about 13,000 freshwater pearls in the air to form a cloud shape. This work, I titled it the cloud cell. The shape is inspired by a Chinese scholar's rock. And also, I also twisted it to refer to our auspicious cloud, but also a nuclear, the mushroom cloud after the aftermath of the nuclear bomb.
Of course.
So I put a lot of information in that form. So this work implies the insertion of science into nature. And it's ever more even macroscopic examination of its cellular makeup, because it's formed with so many small dots to form this big image of a cloud. And also the name cloud cell suggests the biological biology and cosmology imagery that under the formation of the cloud. So it also contributing to other pathway in human exploration of the nature, of the universe too. And a cloud and also long be associated with longevity in Chinese culture as the habitat for the immortals. And I use this form to refer to the cloud and also the scholar stone. And the scholar stone in Chinese culture is, I don't know if you're familiar with it. The ancient Chinese will take the stone that formed in the nature, it's kind of get rewashing with the water and forming this clean, very linear form. And then the scholars will take those from the nature and put in a wooden stand on the desk. Then they can contemplate with the stone. And it's for them to contemplate, admire. And then the nuclear bomb, the cloud, like a mushroom cloud, is a destructive image of a nuclear bomb. So this dichotomy within one piece. Yeah, so I present this all to the viewer, let them to contemplate on this image. Yeah. So that's my first work kind of deal with directly with these environmental issues. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're picking up symbolism from different cultures as well. Obviously, the mushroom cloud is most associated with Western modernist culture, And then you've just explained beautifully the scholar stone, which is definitely associated with Eastern philosophy and more nature-based culture. So you're integrating both those symbols. You're integrating, you know, science and nature again with those symbols through the pearl. I mean, it's really fascinating to hear how all of this is embedded. And I think on a subconscious level, we may get some of that from viewing the piece, but I do love hearing the explanation. It kind of opens up all new perspectives for me when I look at it, just hearing your explanation. And talk about, too, the materials you use, because pearls aren't necessarily the first artistic material people think of. So, you know, what inspires your use of materials and what are some of the different, maybe less traditional materials that your artwork uses?
Well, I do see pearl as a quite a traditional material, but maybe not in the contemporary art making, but it's in the jewelry. Like people in China wear pearls for centuries and also in the West too. Maybe that's because of my jewelry background. Yeah. And also China is produced probably, I think I read somewhere, more than 92% of the freshwater pearls in the world. So that make it even more symbolic, like more symbolic in the Chinese economy in the world. And also the city I lived when I was a child, it called the Pearl City. It used to be a famous part produce pearls, but because the change of the water, I don't know exactly what happened, and that the city now don't really produce that many pearls anymore, but I still keep the name. And there are many sculptures in the city that refer to the history and the name, you know, the nickname of the city.
Right.
And also pearl is like the freshwater pearl is man-controlled product. So, you know, human, we put little beads into the clam and then let the bead grow a layer of the mother pearl. And then we harvest the pearls. So it's a man-controlled process. It's also like lingzhi and other materials, like natural, we assume to be natural materials. Now they're all human-controlled process.
Yes, that's another layer of symbology. And I guess for you, just in the creative process, are all of these different layers something you're conscious of when you choose a material like pearls or maybe pines, or I mean, we can get into some of the other art pieces, but you just laid out so many different layers of symbolism and relevance attached to this, just the material. Is that all conscious when you pick to use pearls, or does that come to you later that you start to realize, oh, this represents this and this in my life? Or is that usually pretty well thought out from the start for you?
Well, a lot of those meanings and the characteristics of the material, I have been thought a lot before I make my decision. But some of that was kind of a discovery along the process, and some even come after I made the work. So yeah, it's all, but actually even the information I acquired after the work is finished, but it helped for me to move, you know, to the next project to solve some of the issues I didn't solve or didn't realize in my last piece.
Yeah, so I'm always amazed by that too, how sometimes this creative process of an artist can even have some mysteries in there for you to discover. You know, you may think, I'm learning more about now why I chose that material. You may be something in your subconscious kind of coming through, and then you're able to then get another layer yourself out of your work. That's really interesting. You know, another work that I was really intrigued by was your Song of the Cicada. Tell us a little bit about the creation of that work. Again, a very, in my mind, you may tell me that this is a traditional material that's been used before, but to me, it sounds like a very non-traditional material. Tell us a little bit about the creation of that work and what you were conveying with the Song of the Cicada.
Yeah, the cicada is another symbol I employed in my work. Cicada does not have much of a place in the mainstream Western culture, right, but it has been highly respected in Chinese culture.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So the cicada is an insect thought to live only on wind and rain drops because it does not really eat anything other than the liquid from the root, from the roots of the trees. Right. And so it symbolizes the simple life and incorruptible personality in ancient Chinese literature. Mm. And so there are many like poems and other written materials highly prized cicada. And yeah, since it, you know, lives underground for years before shedding its skin, so the cicada considered a magical creature. And it believe it can connect the three realms together, you know, the heavenly, earthly, and the human realms.
Amazing.
So yeah, so in the old time, rich family would put a jade carved cicada in the mouth of a deceased person, just hope they can have a good rebirth, because ancient Chinese believe in the reincarnation. So yeah, so the ancient Chinese also regarded cicada as a symbol of immortality. And it's always considered a magical, you know, object and also, you know, symbol, and also carries spiritual significance. Mm. And even nowadays in the feng shui, they use it, you know, for the immortality and protection against backstabbers kind of, you know, idea. Yeah. Buddhism also highly regard cicada as well. So the idea that life is transient and impermanent, passing through a cycle, what the Buddhists called samsara, that means birth and death. So yeah, so that they use this cicada as a symbol for that too. And also the notion of non-self, which possess that self is an illusion, that one should be without the outer layer, a skeleton of a human, known in the West term as an ego. So it's a more abstract concept. Yeah. And I always been completing, you know, on this kind of idea of the ego that, you know, referred to this exoskeleton of the cicada. When we shed our skin, maybe we transform as a new person with our ego.
A very important perspective, I think, for a lot of the modernist Western world probably to embrace. And now, was that some of the message you wanted to convey? Because you're bringing a very relevant Eastern symbol into the consciousness of, you know, a Western culture. What maybe were you trying to communicate? Was it some of that idea of rebirth? Hey guys, maybe it's time to lose the ego a little bit. Or was there any intended message as you kind of put that very traditional Eastern symbol through a Western lens?
Yes, I think for cicada itself alone to express the idea of rebirth, the cycle of life, right, is still a little bit too hard for the Western viewer. So I hand like over 33,000 of the cicada exoskeletons in the air to form a spiral staircase. So I also painted all those cicadas with gold paint.
Yes.
So then it's forming a golden staircase. I think that kind of re-emphasized on this concept of transformation and, you know, the staircase to heaven is such a, you know, popular concept in the Western culture. So yeah, so that's, and also I do like the idea, like the concept of the staircase, because a staircase connect three spaces together, like the cicada, you know, underground, above the ground, and also heavenly. And it is exists in an in-between and beyond space.
Right.
And as like also bridge is, you know, is similar. I created a bridge years ago, also used the similar concept, a transition space, a third space. And also I see myself as an immigrant, actually is, you know, represented by the bridge or the staircase. I'm living, or I am, you know, in the third space and, you know, belong to nowhere, but connecting both culture or both world together. And also when you are in this space, you can look at both sides and you have a unique perspective. Yeah, I think it's adds such a richness to the life experience.
I mean, what a potent symbol you're able to put together with a work like that using cicadas. I loved just looking at this golden staircase. And of course, when I first glanced the piece online, I didn't realize those were all cicadas. But yeah, what a powerful symbol to have about ascension. And yes, maybe ascending the ego or death and rebirth to kind of this idea of a higher self that I think resonates with everyone. You know, that's the whole idea of self-improvement. You could argue that's maybe a large reason of why we're here. And I've often heard what you're describing as kind of the third realm or the in-between as liminal space, a space exactly. In between realities that kind of lets you have access to unique information, ideas, perspectives that you wouldn't get if you had your foot in, you know, one static reality. So a really powerful image to play with. And before you were telling us how making this art, you know, has helped you reconcile your identity as someone kind of in between two cultures and get more comfortable with that bridge that you kind of are between both worlds. You know, do you think then that artists have a big role in helping us all, maybe helping more modernist society integrate and understand our relationship with the natural world as maybe part of it or in between human modernity and nature? I mean, are artists going to be some of the most important people in helping us navigate that relationship to be in balance with nature, but also be mindful of human needs and progress?
I don't think that artists will be the most important, like take on the most important role in this process. But certainly artists has contributed, are and are going to contribute to this process. And I think to be able to achieve that goal, and each and every one of us are responsible.
So ultimately, it's going to be everyone's collective responsibility. Artists may just give us focal points or reminders maybe about that process and how each of us needs to engage with this work or with this journey.
Yeah, exactly. Artists can pose some questions, can use more artistic way, maybe make some scientific ideas pass to the general public, as maybe, you know, for scientists, the data and all those very abstruse articles is hard for the general public. Yeah. And art is more accessible, and it maybe is more, can spread ideas more wider.
That's a big theme right now, is this concept of science communication. And I like to think that's a little bit of the work I do in talking with folks who are interested in mycology or mushrooms and communicating that to a broader audience. And I think what you're saying is absolutely correct, that artists are going to have roles in that scientific communication. A really, really interesting idea, this blend. You know, people hold up this idea of a spectrum between art and science, when usually they actually work best when they're kind of hand in hand and and working together. Now for you, how do you maintain your connection with the natural world? Obviously, you're working with natural materials. These themes are probably constantly in your mind, in your imagination. But do you have any practice where you get out into nature, go hiking, maybe go foraging for mushrooms? How do you maintain your own connection with nature? And how does that affect your work, you know, whether you're feeling very connected or not?
Well, I think for that aspect, I'm very fortunate to live in Canada. We have a lot of nature resources, and like going hiking or camping, which would be so hard to do if I would stay in China. And it's so populated there, and it's hard to find quiet places, like 2 or 3 hours driving distance to just spend a night. If you want to, like, I guess, an impromptu trip. Yeah, and I like to go hiking. Like, every weekend, our family will go out to some, you know, nearby parks to hike for a few hours. And I like camping and like to go to the remote places to see, you know, the untouched nature, not entirely unattached, but to the most it can be.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, those experience has really nurtured me for my ideas, for my art. And also, I like to read books about, especially some mythical literatures, you know, inspired by nature and stories, and, you know, from different cultural background, not only from China, and to see that how people, how, you know, other cultures, how our ancestors engage with nature, how the spirituality that has contributed to our civilization.
Yes, that idea of, again, looking to the past to see what kind of relationship they have with nature, what kind of spiritual cosmology was built around it. And there may be themes and ideas that could be very valuable for us today. I'm a firm believer in that. So it's really interesting to hear that that's part of your creative process. Now, we've been talking about your work with nature, some of the really potent themes you're playing with. Then we get into Lingzhi. Obviously, that's where I was first introduced to your work. I saw both the sculptures you were doing with Lingzhi, or what we know here in America as Reishi mushroom or Ganoderma mushroom. But you also, I know, made an app filter where I had Lingzhi growing out of my face. So when did Lingzhi enter your art? And I guess, you know, was it already a part of your life before you started using it as a material or using it in your art?
If you ask any Chinese people about Lingzhi, they all know. It's such like ubiquitous existence in China.
Right.
And with such magical symbol and stories. So every Chinese people know about it. So I grew up with I would call it Lingzhi culture, surrounded by the Lingzhi culture. Yeah, and then I think a lot of people would know that Lingzhi is a traditional medicine, and then Chinese people has been using it for over 2,000 years. And also it is called mushroom of immortality, and it's highly regarded as a both magical herbs and also an auspicious sign of good fortune and mythical power. Then since the ancient time, there has been like numerous myth and literature, like mentioning people's devotion, worship, and belief in Lingzhi. I really like the story about how Lingzhi start to have this magical power. So it's a story from a famous book of mountain and sea. It's from about 400 BC. So in the book, it says the flame emperor. So he's a legendary ancient Chinese ruler in the pre-dynastic time. So he had four beautiful daughters, and each had a very beautiful legend. So his third daughter, Yao Ji, her name's Yao Ji, and was a very beautiful and sentimental girl. But unfortunately, she died very young and was buried in a mountain near a river. So her soul clung to a Lingzhi mushroom and made this mushroom a mushroom of immortality. So whoever ate it can become immortal. And also because she liked bamboo bushes, and then, you know, Lingzhi mushroom with bamboo bushes together become the central theme for many Chinese artists.
That's incredible. So, yeah. I've never heard that story before. And that's where this idea of the herb of immortality or the mushroom of immortality comes from then.
Well, that's only one of the legend for that idea. So there are many legends about that. Yeah, but it's hard to really tell exactly the origin of the concept of immortality of the mushroom.
Yeah.
But it's one of the more important story about that.
I mean, I knew it was ubiquitous in Chinese culture, but I think you've just elucidated that beautifully. And I'm struck by how this is probably another one of these traditional or ancient elements of Chinese culture that you're bringing forward into modern society. And I think you know, specifically this appreciation for mushrooms, both medicinally and just as the amazing organisms that they are. That's what so many people like myself who are in kind of the modern mushroom loving movement in the US, you know, we're classically a very mycophobic culture compared to Eastern cultures like China, who are very mycophilic, mushroom loving versus mushroom fearing, you know, and now we're starting to see that change a lot here in the Western kind of modernist society. And so I think it's the perfect time and maybe no accident that you're bringing through kind of this ancient Chinese theme and putting it and giving it to the Western culture and kind of channeling it through the lens of Western culture. Really, really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. We eat a lot of mushrooms in China. Not many people can really go mushroom foraging in the forest, but the mushroom cultivation industry in China is very advanced. And there are a lot of mushrooms selling on the market. And also there are a lot of this dried mushroom, you know, you can buy like a packaged dried mushroom. So they can store for long, you know, store for longer time. So you can, you know, really easily can consume them. Yeah.
Now, do you see the change that I described? Because I think that's something a lot of people have a sense of, is that mushrooms are getting more popular in the West. But sometimes I think, well, that's because I only hang out with mushroom people that I think that, you know, do you see that as someone coming from a culture that, you know, everyone has an appreciation for mushrooms, basically? Do you see that changing maybe where you are in Canada or Western society more broadly?
Well, it's really hard to say. As for myself, because I pay more attention to mushrooms, and I feel
you're biased that,
like
too.
You said, maybe, yeah, I can't really be, you know, objective, like subjective to this. Like, you know, it's, and I've been talking to many other people, but a lot of them have the same comments that, you know, there, you know, lots of people from outside of Canada, like from different cultural backgrounds, rather than in China, then they all have the same feeling that, you know, here people don't eat a lot of mushrooms. They have this such fear towards fungi and mushrooms, this kind of thing. Yeah. I hope it will change, at least.
Well, maybe your art is going to help us with that transition. And
yeah, certainly. It contributes a small amount, at least I know.
I definitely think so. And how do you make the art with Lingzhi? Tell us a little bit about your process of actually using the organism to create art. You know, where do you begin and how do you make these beautiful art pieces with the mushroom?
Yeah, actually, my first using mushroom was not really making the real Lingzhi, grow the Lingzhi mushroom. I was more like joining to the concept of longevity of Lingzhi. So I think, you know, once, you know, we grow older, then our relationship with life and death become different. So then, you know, there was, you know, the loss of family members and friends in my life. So that make me start to think about the idea of life and death again. Then also like the stories of this longevity, immortality concept, you know, of Lingzhi kind of researched in my mind. And then I started to think I, you know, wanted to use Lingzhi, the symbolism of Lingzhi, to create a work. Then I bought a dozen of Lingzhi mushrooms, and then I had them cast into bronze. And I gave them a finish of patina, like greenish turquoise patina. And then this enhanced the texture on the mushroom.
Yeah.
So they kind of look like the tree rings. And then they also mimic the bronze vessels and artifacts from museums. So the material also speaks sense, you know, the bronze material also speaks to the sense of aging and the passage of time. And also I'm just start thinking, you know, this bronze is often associated with monuments, images of power or eternity. But actually, they're not that long-lasting as we assume. They usually get recycled, melted down, recycled.
Right.
but the mushroom, the Lingzhi mushroom, we would think them just an organism. But, you know, in the Forbidden City in Beijing, the Qianlong Emperor from probably 300 years ago, he was a fan of Lingzhi mushroom. He collected a lot of Lingzhi mushroom, the real one, like big big ones.
Yeah.
And he displaced them by embedding those mushrooms into cabinets or on wood carving stand, like, you know, those scholar rocks would be displayed.
Yeah.
So then those mushrooms, some of the mushrooms also have a poem written by the emperor on its surface with gold paint. Yeah, so that's from a few hundred years ago. And so they actually not that fragile or ephemeral as we assumed. So that's, they really create such tension between Lingzhi's delicacy, nature, and the mythology with the replacement of the material to a bronze. Yeah, that's how I started working with Lingzhi. And later on, I went to a farm, mushroom farm in China. So I saw, they were growing those Lingzhi mushrooms. And those ones, two very rare and precious mushrooms, now like become so mass-produced.
Right.
So I was kind of amazed by that. And then they become so unified, like in color, size, and shape. And, compared to the wild Lingzhi mushroom, they're like irregular in the color, shape, and size. So then I started thinking maybe I should think a way to use the Lingzhi mushroom itself as a material and to grow sculptures out of this. That's how I started my experimentation. Yeah.
Well, and I think everyone who's seen Lingzhi growing with the antlers coming out, these beautiful forms that get made, you see it as a natural work of art. I mean, especially, yes, once you have the big fruit body, the big conch, which it sounds like what you were using initially, casting it in bronze, those are, of course, are beautiful as well. I'm still kind of trying to process the idea that the emperor in the Forbidden City has made these incredible Lingzhi sculptures almost with poems written on them, and they've lasted for hundreds of years. That does kind of shift my perspective on how long lasting these organisms are. You know, when you're casting them in bronze, it turns out the bronze part might be more ephemeral than the Lingzhi. But yes, this idea of growing them, that always seems like an art process in itself whenever you cultivate Lingzhi. Now, is that something where you're trying to control the growth at all? Or in your artwork, are you setting up the substrate where they're going to grow and just letting them grow however they want to? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I actually create like a mold for them to grow. And that was quite an experiment for me because I didn't know what kind of mold would work for the mycelium. And I have been using rubber mold or silicone mold in the past for my other sculptures.
Right.
So I thought, I could try those, but it turned out that because the rubber or silicone has a lot of pores, and then the little holes the mycelium would grow into and then become, together, and you can't really separate the sculpture from from the mold. And so I could not use the silicone or rubber mold. And so I was kind of limited to use some of those kind of plastic surface. So eventually I created those molds with fiberglass resin, and then I sanded the inside of the mold very smoothly and apply high gloss of paint. So the surface will be very close to plastic.
Yeah.
So that it won't adhere to the mycelium. And that also gave me a lot of limitation on the complexity of the sculpture. Because with this kind of rigid mold, you can't do very detailed mold. But it was good enough for me to achieve whatever I want to achieve with more just, less detailed surface. Yeah. But because later on, when the mycelium or mushrooms start growing, and the details will be eat out anyway.
right. The details get lost to the giant fruiting bodies. Yeah. And what was the first work of art then that you made with the actual growing, with these forms and growing Lingzhi?
So I created a body of work. I titled them Lingzhi Girl. So I created portraits. Like I first sculpted those clay portrait, a bust, and then I cast it into fiberglass resin negative mode. And then I stuff those substrate with link dispersed together into the mold. After few weeks, then after the substrate become white, so I gently remove the mold and then put this mycelium sculpture into a green house, like a little tent I created. I like everyone, grow mushroom would know that process. So I control the humidity level, the amount of light, and also the temperature, and then just, let it grow. And so that's from that part, that time I lost my control and nature take over. So whatever it'll grow into, or where the lingzhi will grow out, or to what form they're going to grow, is totally out of my control. And at the beginning, I try to control, to interfere with the process, but I don't really want total control. I want the freedom. I want to see what nature will do in that process, because it's in my eyes, it's my collaboration with nature, and each side has the chance to shine, and each side has, have to give the respect. So I just left that to the nature.
I mean, an incredible concept, this idea. It sounds like you felt like you were more co-creating with another organism rather than using, quote unquote, the organism to make your art. You were creating art with the help of the lingzhi.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's an incredible perspective to have. And I think a lot of people who develop a relationship with fungi start to get that perspective as you spend more time with them, that they are more organism than material. And you start to develop this kind of reciprocal relationship. Now, did you find that more so in working with it as a living organism compared to when you use biological materials that aren't actively growing and alive? Did you find that you thought more about this reciprocal relationship between man and nature and creation because it was alive?
Exactly. The alive aspect has really given the work very different characteristics. And in contrary to my other works, like those, like the pro installation, when I make the design and I had a computer, design assist right, to calculate each location of the pros, and they had joins precisely, and I hired people to help me, so they thread those pros according to the join precisely as they can, and then it was a totally controlled process,
right,
and the result will be very similar to the rendering. And versus that, and this was working with lingzhi, and the result is unknown. The known thing is that I created this bust of the young girl, and what it will turn into, I have no idea. So I grew about 18 of those busts from the same mold, each of them taking on its own unique form. So none of them are the same. And so that aspect is like you're raising a child. Even they're, all your child, they're all going to be different.
Right.
They have different personality. They have different, outlook. And so they grow differently.
Yeah, sounds like working with living materials is a much more intimate process, yeah, like raising a child. And we might have to update then the label on those art pieces for Lingzhi Girl to read, artist Zhao Jingyan and Lingzhi Mushroom. Because they're kind of the artist as well.
Yes. Yeah. Or maybe nature.
Or maybe the Mother co-artist nature. Needs to be nature. Well, and what has the public's response been to these works? When you've shown them at exhibitions, have people kind of understood and picked up this symbolism? Or what's that response been? Maybe from the public and maybe from other people in the art world, gallery curators and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see the response actually. When I first saw the work, actually, I was quite amazed. And also, same time, I think it was such an uncanny, outlook, appearance.
Yeah.
It looked a little bit scary.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, for people don't really know what is really going on, this kind of deformed, like a human form. Yeah, and then when I showed it in the gallery, and the response actually from Chinese viewers are very different than the West viewers. And when the Chinese people learned that, you know, when they read the label or when they discovered that it's Lingzhi, then they immediately get become delighted by the discovery. Then they feel so intimate and, you know, they feel, you know, very acceptant with the work.
Yeah.
Even they look such different than they usually would deal with. Yeah. And for Western people, like we were, I think Lingzhi is not exclusive in Chinese culture. Just here, like in Canada, I saw quite often when I go hiking, I saw Lingzhi mushrooms. But they're not really giving the culture association or connotation. So people only regard them as a very beautiful, like rare fungus. And they like the idea of collaborating with nature. They like the surprising and uncanny appearance of the sculpture. And then, you know, then some people in the West also know more about Lingzhi's medical properties. So yeah, so they kind of get the idea of the healing aspect of Lingzhi. But, you know, if they are interested enough, when they start reading the artist statement, they would learn a lot about Lingzhi in the Chinese culture. And then, you know, a lot of them come to me and tell me, oh, I'm so amazed about, you know, learning all this and, you know, seeing that how you work with the nature, how those are, you know, those past are actually cultivated by the mushroom.
Yeah, it's amazing to look at the art pieces. Obviously, for anyone listening, I encourage you to go to Xiaoxing's website, or if you just search Lingzhi Girl, you'll probably find it online. They are stunning, and there is something, yeah, a little bit eerie about them, but also something all too familiar because it is another living organism. They're really amazing pieces. Now, do you see this working with living materials, maybe specifically fungi, as a growing kind of discipline in the art world that you're kind of at the frontier of? Do you see that more artists may want to get involved with using, you know, fungi as an ally in creating art? Do you think that's something that's going to be more relevant moving into the future?
Well, I see a lot of designer, like architect and artist are using the mycelium material as a material to replace some traditional materials to, you know, to create work. And yeah, I certainly can say it's a trend there, but also because the slow growth of mycelium, it's hard to get enough material for, you know, for a product or for, especially for mass production. I think there's a lot have to be studied to overcome, to achieve the, you know, the outcome we want.
Right.
But certainly I can see the future if, you know, we can, you know, manipulate this material to a certain extent that it can replace packaging and, you know, the plastic, so it can save our planet.
I think a lot of us hope so. But it's also this idea that, yes, we're going to have to get more and more familiar with cultivating them. And I'm sure as an artist, even though you're coming from a culture that's so immersed and so familiar with Lingzhi, you probably still had to learn a lot about cultivation just to be able to work with the organism.
Oh, exactly. And even I was so familiar with Lingzhi and its culture connotations, but when I first worked with it, I had no idea. I mean, I didn't associate it with fungi at all.
Interesting.
I just thought it was, I mean, I knew it was a fungi, but in my mind, it was separated. It was just by itself. It's such a strong icon there. So, and also because in Chinese culture, it has another nickname. It's called the celestial grass. So it can be called grass. So it was kind of, I think maybe the ancient Chinese tried to differentiate it from other, you know, fungi that does not have this magical connotations with it. Yeah, so my, you know, the journey with Lingzhi, I learned so much. I didn't know, like, when I start growing them, the, you know, carbon dioxide level and the humidity and the light condition, they all can contribute to the shape of the Lingzhi. So when I had, you know, this 18 baths, then, you know, all the Lingzhi, you know, each of them, they're all different forms. They're like, some of them have like this typical shelf-like fungi kind of, you know, from, you know, you can say like from the Chinese herbal stars.
Yeah.
And also there are some kind of like this toadstool kind of Lingzhi with the long stem. And also they have this antler-shaped, like horn-like forms. And I was kind of beginning, I was thinking, did I have like different types of Lingzhi strains in my, you know, substrate?
right. Different species or strains.
Yeah, why they're different. So that slowly I find, you know, I'm starting, you know, my research and trying to figure out what was going on. Then I learned that actually they grow differently based on environmental conditions. So, and also other factors. Then I was thinking, maybe, you know, Lingzhi, they're like human and they're shaped by, you know, culture and environment. They're, you know, assume different forms and behave differently based on, you know, the different environment. So that's like our human body. We readily respond to a variety of biological and cultural ways to, you know, to the changing environmental stresses. So, you know, we can acclimatize to a wide range of temperature and humidity level. You know, not only we can sweat through our skins, we also can develop different clothes to wear and different house to live for different climates. So like our cognitive ability help us to adapt to a novel environment. And then, you know, this turns out we're similar, you know, to Lingzhi in this aspect.
Yes, and that's something important to keep in mind about fungi in general, is how individuals within a species can behave differently, look differently. It's one of those unique things that does kind of make us think of their relationship to us as humans or as, you know, animals in general. Yeah. You know, the common phrase is, you know, mushrooms are somewhere between plants and animals. And while it's a little bit of a simplification, things like that, how individuals seem to differentiate, kind of does make us think of that. Really, really fascinating. Really fascinating. And I think I'm definitely going to start using the name celestial grass, because it does sound incredible and kind of brings this air of mysticism to the Lingzhi.
Yeah.
Well, I guess then what is in the future for you? You know, what direction now is your work going to take? Have you become totally inoculated with the mycelium and you're now going to make more mushroom art? Or what directions are you looking toward in your art? And do you have any projects or exhibitions coming up?
Well, yeah, and I do have several projects and exhibitions come up. And one is going to be in Paris. Yeah, so that exhibition has been propounded for 2 years.
Oh my, of course.
Yeah. And also I'm working on a couple of other projects. One project I'm actually working on is supported by Canada Art Council grant and is a continuation on my Lingzhi exploration. So I'm working on another series of experimental Lingzhi sculptures. I'm trying to grow Lingzhi on found furniture. And it has been quite a challenge because the wood, you know, the way the wood of the furniture and the way it has been, you know, previously treated, it's totally out of my control.
Of course.
And so I haven't, and also it because the slowly when you grow fungi on a, you know, solid wood, and it take months and months to see slow result. So yeah, I hope, you know, with enough experimentation, there will be a field that become a showcase for the wonder of nature's creation. Yeah. And also, I hope by doing this, I can give the furniture a new life and a purpose. then I can draw awareness towards a deeper understanding of human nature relationships.
I think that that's one of the most noble things we can do in this day and age, is to find that purpose to show people the wonder of nature and show people, you know, how intimately connected with it we are with these organisms. So I think it's really powerful work. And I'm sure anyone listening like myself just wants to learn more about this and see more of your work. Where's the best place for people to find you, maybe connect with you? Is it on social media? Are there websites? Where are the best places for people to find your work? Maybe where it's exhibiting, all that kind of information.
Well, they can visit my website, yanxiaojing.com, yanxiaojing.com. Yeah, and also I'm on Instagram too.
Yes, and we're going to put the links to all of that. And I can't believe I almost forgot about Instagram. Tell us a little bit about what inspired the Lingzhi Girl filter and how people can get this filter for their Instagram app.
Well, that was actually because of the lockdown in March last year. So immediately all my project got postponed or canceled. So I get a lot of time.
Right.
And then I saw some people were kind of playing with some kind of filters on Instagram. It was kind of fun. And then I started to think maybe I could create something with my Lingzhi sculpture. Then instead of the Lingzhi, you know, grow from the sculpture, then maybe it can grow from our real body in the virtual way.
Yeah.
So that's how the idea came from. Then it was actually harder than I expected. It took me a lot of time and with help too to figure out how to create that filter. That it worked out pretty good. Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And for anyone listening, if you have Instagram, go get the Lingzhi Girl filter. It's a lot of fun to play with. You blink and Rishi start emerging from your face, these little antlers and then these big, beautiful conch shells. I just thought that was so creative and so fun. And it makes sense that in light of, you know, in-person exhibitions being shut down, you channeled this creativity somewhere else. So Xiaojing, I'm going to wrap up with three questions that I like to ask all of my guests. And the first one, I'm going to ask you a mushroom that you really love and why, but I might say if you can pick another one besides Lingzhi. I mean, we know that you love Lingzhi. We can see why. It's an incredible mushroom, the celestial grass, the mushroom of immortality. But is there another mushroom that has a special place in your heart?
Well, I think besides Lingzhi, the other mushroom I love the most is Amanita mushroom. Yeah, I love the brilliant color. And then also the, you know, the shape, the umbrella shape. And also similar to Lingzhi, the long history of human using Amanita mushroom, you know, can be traced probably for thousands of years, as I read. Yeah. And also in the European culture, Amanita mushroom has such rich history and with, you know, in the shaman traditions.
Yes.
So yeah, it's another, I think it's the mystical mushroom in the West for me.
So yes, you have your favorite mushroom in the East, the Lingzhi, and favorite mushroom in the West, maybe the infamous Amanita muscaria. And I was curious, is there any history of using that bright red mushroom in China? I've actually heard that there is a historical use in Japan. Is there any history or relationship with that Amanita in China that you know of?
Not as I know of.
Interesting.
And China is a big country, and you know, from region to region, it may be different. Maybe in some culture, like we have many minorities in China, like different Aboriginal people from the past. And then maybe there, you know, some of those people are using the mushroom, but it's not like very wide known of. So I don't have much knowledge of that. Yeah, but for me to learn that, to know that mushroom, it's more from those like cartoons or fairy tales, like these books, like pictures from the West that depicting this mushroom, with fairies or toads sitting on it, have, you know, like fairy tales.
Well, that's amazing that this is a fungi that you've developed a relationship with in the West. Another example of kind of this bridge that you're making between cultures. Really interesting. And this next question is a really broad question. You can kind of go any direction you want with it. But what has this relationship that you developed with Lingzhi and maybe with fungi more broadly? And I mean, you've worked with it with your hands, touching it, and cultivating it, and really spending a lot of time with it. How has that relationship you've developed with these organisms changed you? Or what has that given to you, maybe in terms of different insights or perspectives?
Yeah, I think this Lingzhi mushroom has become a window for me to understand the inner workings of nature in a more profound way. So it is a bridge to our biological history and our ancient past. Yeah, and then through this mushroom, I learned so much about the culture, the science, you know, the social issues that are associated with it. And even like nowadays, during this COVID time, and I, you know, kind of start to self-reflect on this relationship between life and death again. Yes. I feel I can resonate greatly, you know, with people in the past, how, you know, in ancient time, how they felt when there was, you know, the cause of certain disease was not understood. The cure had to rely on traditional methods for remedy. And the Lingzhi and other, you know, thought to be kind of magical mushrooms, part of the traditional medicine, and also regarded, you know, as a symbol for protection. So those yes. are the, you know, objects that, you know, people would think that can provide reassurance. So that's kind of make me think a lot about, you know, when we feel so powerless in the face of natural disasters, then maybe looking back to our ancestors and their relationship to nature can help us to reflect upon and build resilience using natural means.
Oh, what an incredible idea and concept you've just brought up there. And I think that is something that so many of us are exploring at this time, is this return to ancient wisdom, indigenous wisdom, their relationships with nature, and use that as part of the solution for how we move forward in the face of adversity, fear, the unknown, in a modern world where we felt like we totally had control over nature, when we're faced with something like, you know, a disease we can't control, how maybe returning to more ancient ways, more ancient relationships with the natural world may be part of the solution forward only makes, you know, makes so much sense. So yeah, I absolutely love that idea. And I think you've just said something that I agree with so much for myself, that's a really,
thank you.
that's a really beautiful sentiment. And then we've talked a lot about, you know, the balance that you're portraying in your art between nature and science, maybe the illusion of control that science or humans feel like we have over nature. We've talked about the balance between, you know, modernist culture and more ancient indigenous culture. For you, what's your greatest hope of how we can balance these different ideas moving forward? I mean, do you see a future where we are able to successfully pull ancient wisdom into the present and use it in a very holistic way? Or what's kind of the greatest aspiration for how we can balance these different themes successfully for a better future?
Yeah, I think for sure, when we look into the past, like the indigenous culture and our ancestors, see how they lived with nature, then we, you know, we can try to identify current ideas that respond to the past and the future, and explore those kind of intertwined relationships with nature. And certainly we can, you know, find inspiration to find a path to our future. And I think the best way probably would be moving from control over nature to partnership with nature, as, you know, show nature enough respect and show the, you know, enough respect to other living things on this planet and beyond.
That is a hope I think so many of us have just hearing your words. I think so many of us resonate with that. And Yeah, I think that'll offer a lot of solutions. Becoming partners with nature, we don't know all of the different issues that's going to help us address, but I think it's an answer in so many different ways, maybe even in ways we can't fully appreciate yet. But just that different mindset is going to help us deal with a lot of our modern problems moving forward. Well, Xiaojing, it has been an absolute pleasure to get the chance to speak with you. You've offered really unique perspectives and insights, shared stories, and shared your own cultural history with us. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I really appreciate you coming on the Mushroom Hour.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.